My subject this morning is Say Yes to Life. If there was anyone I ever knew who did exactly that, it was Master Paramahansa Yogananda. He was very different from that category of saint who is denying always. He did deny delusion, but always in an affirmative attitude of affirming God, affirming life's joy. He didn't feel the need to exclude this world and its beauties. I remember a saint that I met in India, in the town of Puri. He was about 132 years old and was a Nagasadhu. He wore no clothes. His whole idea was that he didn't want anything to do with the world. And he told me that one should not enjoy beautiful scenery, beautiful music, good things, that everything should be not this, not anything, only God. Yogananda's attitude was based in that, and yet it took it that very necessary step, that next step forward, which is to say that after having understood it right, it's like that Upanishad which says that you should learn to live in this world without attachment to anything. And then, once you have no attachment to anything, wish to live for 100 years enjoying it. Which is to say that it isn't that it's bad in itself, it's that if we enjoy it in the wrong way, then true happiness doesn't come to us. If we enjoy it in the right way, everything is God. So the first attitude may indeed be neti neti, as the Indian scriptures say, not this, not that. But afterwards, when you've really convinced your mind that you don't belong here, then you can enjoy everything, and much more freely, like a story of Master when he went to Radio City Music Hall in New York. And he paid his admission. He said, now this place is mine. And so he walked around enjoying his beautiful palace, and the beautiful curtain, the stage, the lovely upholstery on the seats, everything. He enjoyed it for an hour or longer, and then he came back and gave the place back to the management and left a free man. And this was his way of, in telling this story, it was his way of saying that we can enjoy everything, we don't have to own a thing to enjoy it. In fact, once you own it, you're more likely to be afraid for it, and therefore your enjoyment is less. I went to visit the ambassador from Chile in New Delhi many years ago. He had another title. It wasn't ambassador, it was plenipotentiary, which sounded very grand indeed. But he was a man of considerable wealth and culture, and he served me tea on his beautiful china, very expensive. I enjoyed it thoroughly because it was beautiful, but I found that he wasn't enjoying it. He was always afraid when the servant brought it in. He was shouting at the servant to put it down carefully. He spent much of our discussion at the tea table talking about the servants in India and how you had to watch them every minute for fear that they'd break something. And then when the servant came to take the dishes away, his shouts followed him all the way down the hallway to the kitchen. And I thought, well, poor man, he would enjoy it if it weren't his. Because it was beautiful. It's this thought of I and mine. A very interesting corollary may be found in the lives of the artists and musicians of the 18th and 19th centuries. The 18th century was a period of classicism, and the individual didn't count so much. The form was more important. That which came through, the place of the artist in society wasn't that exalted either. The artist, although certainly worthy of being looked up to, was not particularly, not nearly as much. And as a result, the music was much less expressive of ego. There was a great deal more sense of flow. And in the 19th century, there came this sort of artistic rebellion against the Industrial Revolution. And with that rebellion came the thought that Well, most people seem to want to go the way of just being ciphers in a big industrial complex and live for the machine and live for money and live in dirt and so on. But sensitive souls would have nothing to do with that. And we are the sensitive souls. We, artists, are those rare souls who see more deeply than mere lucre and filthy lucre. We are able to appreciate the beauty. As John Keats said, there was a rainbow once in heaven, now it is listed in the category of common things. And this great sort of revulsion against the tendency of science to pick things apart, but then to take the heart out of them, was a right attitude in one way, but what it did in a wrong way was exalt the artist as an individual, as an ego. And what we find, interestingly enough, is that in the 19th century, and I haven't heard of it happening really before then, before the 18th also, but in the 19th century we find quite a few artists, composers, who lost their sanity. It even became a truism from that time on that genius is very close to insanity. But it was never considered so before. Why was it considered so from then on? I think because with the emphasis on the ego, there was a block in the natural flow of creativity. The natural flow of creativity, even in a physical sense, the ego is centered here in the medulla. The soul and soul consciousness are centered here in the spiritual eye at the Christ Center. And the natural flow of creativity is to bring the energy from the divine and offer it back to the divine, so that the energy coming up the spine to the brain in the creative mode of the high energy that's required for great creativity, it must go past this thought of I and be offered into the infinite. Otherwise, you get a lot of energy coming up into the brain and being blocked and not released. And that blockage of energy in the ego creates this imbalance that results in insanity. Why, if this is true, are so many egotists in the world not insane? The answer is perfectly simple, because they don't have the energy to be insane. What I'm talking about here is that they haven't, there are other ways of going crazy. Usually craziness is a matter of trying to escape reality. But in this particular context, it's the great rush of energy to the brain which needs to be released, and if it isn't released will result in imbalance. And if there isn't any rush, then you've solved the problem also in a negative way. The creative flow means a tremendous amount of energy. If you read great works of art, of literature, of music, listen to great music, you will notice that there is one thing that always marks it apart from mediocre works: energy. I've often thought of people like François Villon, who was really, he was a great poet in his own way, but he was also a crook. He was a thief. He was not a good man. What made his poetry stand out among all the other poems of France in his century? That he had real energy. He was a thief, yes, but he was an energetic thief. He lived life to the full, and whereas he had his faults, this was a virtue. It was a virtue which highlighted perhaps even his negativity, as all great energy will. It like energy coming through the sun, sunlight coming through the different colored panes of a stained glass window, highlighting all those panes. But you will see that this is one thing that stands out in all great works of art, that they are high energy. And the greater the work of art, the higher the energy. I noticed this many years ago in college. It suddenly came to me that in reading Homer's Iliad, and I had to think, why was this epic such a great story, as to have lived so many years and to have invited the highest possible praise from everyone? It's a rousing, good story, but what is it that separates it? And on a critical level, I wasn't capable, really, of being able to say why it was great. But I knew that it was great. And thinking, why? I mean, from myself, from my own experience of it, I knew that it was great. And trying to understand why, I realized that in thinking of the Iliad, it was as if I saw a blazing light, a brilliant white light. I thought, well, that's an interesting way of criticizing a book. And I started thinking of other books that were great. And I thought of Shakespeare, and I saw there was still light. It wasn't white, but it was sort of a golden, reddish blue. It was a beautiful, but not as intense as the Iliad. And then I came down to somebody like Chaucer, and I saw that the light was sort of brown. Still light, at least. Then I came down to lesser authors, contemporary authors, and so on, and I couldn't feel any light there at all. And it seemed to me that I'd really stumbled on something valid, not something you could really write about. I did write about it and got a flunking grade. But nevertheless, there's a lot of, if the professor couldn't understand it, I could. And if I express what it was that I felt in terms that we can all understand, it comes back to this question of energy. That the higher the energy, the more intense the vibrations. When you read the Ramayana, I read the Ramayana years later and wasn't thinking of it in terms of light so much. But after reading that book, I felt as if bathed in goodness for days afterwards. It was such a holy, clean, wonderful vibration, noble. You notice that, again, however, it was real nobility. It wasn't sort of a lack of energy, like somebody who was trying to write a spiritual song, and so he wrote, "You gotta love, love, love." And then he wrote another one, "You gotta love Jesus." And, and there's no heart in that. There's no energy in that. You don't equate noise with energy. But when you really feel something intensely, this is going to affect. Now, this is what Master was talking about when he talked about when he expressed that quality of saying yes to life. In reading Autobiography of a Yogi, I had the same experience. This wonderful, it just absolutely changed my life, reading that book. I hadn't expected anything, really. All I knew was that something was forcing me to read it. And I was excited by that very thought, because I didn't know what was in the book. I knew that I was very attracted by his his face on the cover. But when I saw that it was dedicated to Luther Burbank, an American saint, I thought, this is absurd. There can't be an American saint. And so I was sort of not sure when I started to read it, but as soon as I got into it, it was talking about things that, frankly, I simply couldn't understand. It was absolutely foreign to my experience that on page 8, a master is materializing himself in a wheat field. There was a great deal there that I simply couldn't accept, because it was not at all anything that I had either read about or heard about or dreamed about, and yet it just didn't matter. I was so absolutely convinced by the greatness of the man that I thought, well, I'll put the rest on a shelf and maybe later I'll understand. But I know that this man couldn't lie to me. I know that this man has what I want. And I took the next bus from New York to Los Angeles and became his disciple. But it was because he said yes to life. I have met many saints in my life, and I have found none that said yes so in such a divine way as he did, to say yes to the right part of life. Because there are a lot of people who say yes in a fragile way. By fragile, I mean that you say yes to something that you think is finally it, and tomorrow it just smacks you in the face with disappointment. Then after that, you're going to be saying no for a long time, aren't you? You put your faith in something that doesn't work, and for a while it goes on fine, and then bit by bit you're disillusioned. I remember what Master said one time when I said to him something about a man I said, he's very honest and very good and very truthful and noble in many ways, but he doesn't love God. And Master's only comment was that the road to Hades is paved with good intentions. What he meant by that was, you can be as good as you like and have lovely ideals, but if you omit the truth, sooner or later you're going to end up not literally in hell. He didn't mean it in that way, but in the hell of disappointment. That's what he was talking about. That you're bound to be disappointed in the end if your ideals are anything less than the highest. If you can live then the way he did, without any attachment, you'll find that without attachment, you can give yourself a lot more. Otherwise, there's always fear. In the art of the romantic poets and musicians and so on, which is beautiful, yes, but it's a lesser beauty. If you listen to it from your own highest side, you listen to somebody like Tchaikovsky as a good example, because he was a wonderful composer. He had a great sense of melody and harmony, and yet there's always a strong undertone of self-pity, of weakness, of cowardice in a way. He was not a strong man. He didn't have real answers in himself. And you feel that. And on the other hand, his melodies are so lovely that if you can sort of keep yourself from falling into a mood listening to him, he's really beautiful as a composer. Another thing is Debussy, who wrote a piece that's perhaps as well known as anything written, Clair de Lune. It's a lovely piece of music, and just to enjoy it for itself is perfectly beautiful. But if you enter into it with a more critical mind, sort of from your own higher self is the way I'm putting it, then you'll see that it's only a mood. It's this particular moonlight. It doesn't put you in touch with all the moons that ever were. It doesn't put you in touch with that greatness of reality that also produces the moonlight. It's not behind the moon, it's in the moon. It's in the mood of the moment. It's not in his center, it's an extension from that center, as if to say that this is my reality, which is never so. Your reality is here, not there. It's attachment. It's thinking that the beauties of nature are your reality, the beauties of this mood are that your reality, and that with that attachment, you can't enjoy nearly so intensely. I used to think that I would never be a really good musician or composer because I never entered into music to the extent of losing myself, losing my center. I would always be relating to it from my center. And then as I got more deeply into these things, I came to understand that that's what all art should be. That it's only when you don't lose yourself that you can completely enter the enjoyment of something, because your enjoyment, your appreciation, your understanding, your reality, everything begins here. If you want to say yes to life, it's what you're saying yes from more than what you're saying yes to that determines the positiveness of that affirmation. That if you can be complete in yourself, then you enter into whatever it is, you bring it to you. You use it. There is this very good analogy given in the Indian Shastras, scriptures, of a wise man is like the capacious ocean where all rivers of pleasure, attachment, desire, whatever it is, all rivers feed that ocean. He enjoys, but he enjoys it with the joy of the soul. He doesn't enjoy it out there and lose himself in it. Whereas worldly people, they're like a mountain lake with all rivers going out from that lake, and if it weren't constantly replenished, it would become dry. And so, when you really want to say yes to life, if you really want to enjoy life, then you should enjoy God. And where do you enjoy God? First here, because only to the extent that you have love in your heart can you love others. They can't bring love out of you if you don't have it within you to respond to it. only to the extent that you have joy in your heart can you enjoy other things, other people, life in general. And so you do need to have the attitude of neti neti for a while and say, I am not that. I am not that. I am not this. I am not the other thing. That isn't me. But once you feel where you are, then you could say, with this joy, love everything. Master said to somebody, you shouldn't love people. And that person was very surprised because Master was so loving. He said, you should love only God. And so the person worked at loving God. Master said this to him because he was too attached to people. And then after some time, when he was really strong in the thought of God's love, Master said, you should love people. And the man said, what do you mean, sir? You told me not to love people. He said, no, love God. But now that you love God in people. And then you love them in the way that they should be loved, and you love them in the way that can draw the best out of them. Because when you see God in people, they feel a touch on that level of their own being, and then they, if they have any responding chord within them, will rise in response to that view of them. So, what we should do is understand the importance of saying yes to life from this level of learning to be affirmative in everything. There are many other reasons why we should be affirmative in everything, to see God in everything. One of the most basic is, you might call it a Dwapara Yuga teaching, because Dwapara Yuga, the new age we've come into, is an age of energy as opposed to an age of matter. In past ages, people saw matter as reality. Now, more and more, people are discovering that energy is the reality behind matter. And energy is that which really determines whatever you can do in life to achieve success. If you want to succeed, it doesn't depend so much upon all the things that you do. It depends much more on the kind of energy that you put out. If you have no blocking energy saying no, then you will find that there's a great deal more energy that you can put forward to achieve whatever it is you're trying to achieve. So much of our energy becomes blocked and neutralized. It's like that story of a man who, a friend of mine who was on a bus in Pakistan, I've told this story before, during the Indo-Pakistani War. And they had to, because it was the war and the planes from India were strafing the highways, go off the highway, and the bus tried to cross a riverbed and got stuck. All the passengers had to get out and push. Well, the bus driver noticed that after 15 minutes it hadn't moved. And so he stepped back from everybody to see what was wrong, and he found that half the passengers were pushing from the front and the other half from the back. Naturally, the bus wasn't moving. Well, this is how people are. Everybody virtually is like this to some extent or another. There's a wish to say yes, but there's also a strong wish to say no. A tendency to negate, a tendency to criticize, a tendency to say, well, it's too much trouble, a tendency to say yes, but what if? All this is static in the mind. It's an obstruction in the mind that whatever energy you're putting out towards success, it's blocking that, and only a little bit comes through. That's why you think you've worked hard, you've worked yourself to exhaustion, and you wonder why the results are so few. You've exhausted yourself pushing on two ends of the bus. You've tried and yet not tried. You've wanted to and yet you've thought, gosh, when it's over, I'll be able to go and take a swim. You've not put yourself wholly into it. You think, well, I want to be kind to people, but if I'm too kind to people, then they're going to expect me to be even more kind, and they're going to be taking up a lot of my time, and maybe I shouldn't be too kind. And you'll find that in anything that you try to do, this is the human tendency to try to work in opposite directions. It's because we were born, in a sense, that way. That is to say, we are here on the scale of evolution. Our soul longs to rise to the heights of divine communion, but our habit, our past, our memory takes us down toward the subconscious from which we have come, the animal level, the subhuman level, the lower human level, all the things that we have gone through in order to arrive where we are today in our desire for truth, which takes a long time to reach even there. But there's always that memory until you've dealt with it completely and completely cleansed your subconscious so that your whole being is going in one direction. There's always that memory that pulls you downward as a simple matter of direction, downward in the spine, back toward your lesser conscious self, your subconscious. And that downward pull is a pull toward negativity, doubt, all the negative emotions of fear, of what if, of it's difficult, laziness. Every human quality that has a downward pull to it is actually born of that downward pull. It doesn't create the downward pull. And if you can change that downward pull into an upward aspiration toward God, that's why you don't need to worry so much about your faults, because you'll never overcome them really that way. You overcome one fault and it just makes room for the other. That's why this song that I started with says that some people think that the way to happiness is by getting rid of your troubles, concentrating on your troubles, like weeding a garden and just sort of straightening it all out. And in this case, the truth is that yes, you have to weed your garden to some extent, but if you just think of it that way, all you really do is get rid of one in order to find another and another and another. It just never ends. Because as long as the pull is downward, then it will create its own negative qualities, even if you've managed to overcome one or another of those negative qualities. The only way out, really, is to say yes to life. What kind of life? Life means the flow of energy in your own being, the divine flow. When Jesus said, "I came that you might have life and have it more abundantly," he didn't mean existence, did he? Everybody around him was existing, and yet he said of them, "Let the dead bury their dead." He saw them as dead because they didn't have the real life, enthusiasm, joy, divine consciousness, energy. They're sort of going through life like whited sepulchres, he called them, mausoleums. No life in them. Most people are like that. You look at their eyes and you see there's no life there. And the more people are engrossed in matter, the deader their eyes are. And the more they are engrossed in the life behind matter, the more they live in that life, the more you see that their eyes too are full of shine to them. I've had an interesting experience sometimes in my life meeting communist officials from Russia. I remember one that I met in a bookstore in New Delhi, and I asked him, "How do you like India?"
"Interesting history."
"Yes, but isn't it it has such a wonderful consciousness here."
"Interesting history."
He was almost frightened that I would pull him out and then get him in trouble with the KGB or something. And his eyes were completely dead. So many of them I've seen, they don't believe anything higher. Their whole life is like this. There's no life in their eyes. They're just walking corpses. The life that Christ came to give, the life that Master affirmed so wonderfully, was a life of the soul. This is life, that which you carry with you when you go. Your body dies, that life continues. And the more you can have of that, if you will affirm that life, if you will affirm, as Master said, don't count your faults. Only think whether you love God enough. Because when you love God, you're affirming that upward move of energy, of consciousness. And in that upward movement of energy and consciousness, all the good qualities begin to suggest themselves to you. You come out of a wonderful meditation and you just can't help feeling wonderful toward everybody. Somebody may insult you, shout at you, and your tendency may have been, as a norm, to shout back, to say, "Yeah, well, you're another," or something. And instead, you just don't feel like saying it. You didn't have to affirm that this is petty to talk like this. You just don't feel like talking like that. You feel like being loving. You feel like being life-affirming and joyful. You feel like being forgiving. Because those are the qualities that manifest themselves, not because you've developed them specifically as qualities, so much as that they are the natural qualities that spring from an upward flow of energy. And the higher that flow of energy, the more naturally virtues develop, and the lower qualities decline. So it is that we need to learn to be, if we would affirm life truly, learn to live in this world without attachment, and then enjoy it, but enjoy it as God's world. Surely God wants us to enjoy this world. There was a heresy in the Christian tradition, the Manichaeans, who had many good teachings, but a basic wrong teaching, and in fact I think it was their basic teaching, was that this world is evil. And this was a heresy indeed, because this world is not evil. We can be evil or good as we choose. There is evil in the world, because there is a conscious power, a satanic power, as well as a conscious good power. But God made this world, and He made it beautiful. And that's why it says, "And the Lord saw the light, and that it was good." And He saw this world, that it is good. But we don't see goodness if we aren't good. We see darkness if we are dark. And you can't have a painting. I was looking at the paintings of Odierna in my house. Odierna is the artist whose paintings I've bought. It was I saw one of his paintings in Capri about 3 years ago. And it was a lovely scene from of Capri with the ocean and plants and the cliffside and the mist and so on, and I thought, gee, it would be beautiful to buy, but it was $400 and I simply couldn't afford it. However, there are certain pictures which remain with you, and I kept thinking about this painting after I went back, and I was sure it had been sold because it was among all the paintings in the shop, set on an easel with a light on it, and I thought, well, anyone that prominently displayed, if the store is doing any business at all, is probably going to end up selling that painting soon. And so I kept wishing that I had bought it then. And then finally, as I was going back to Italy, the thought occurred to me that maybe a shop that would carry one painting by the artist would carry other paintings too. So I went back there in great hope and found that in fact Odierna owned the shop. So almost all the paintings were his, and I ended up buying about 35. There are 26 of them in my house, because they are so they're so joyful. But what makes them joyful, full of color, full of life, vitality? But he gains that not by garishness. Many people think that you have to overstate in order to make a strong statement. But what you do is, as a painter, it's only an example, you create shadow. And against that shadow, colors stand out beautifully, and you don't have to be garish to make it joyful. He's a very sensitive artist. I've been in lots of galleries and seen none that I like as well as his among contemporary artists. And another thing I feel about art is that if you're going to have art in your home, then it should be like a person. I knew that I would like Odierna when I met him, and when I did, I loved him. His work showed who he was. But what you have in a home is a human being, in a way. And if you're going to have a fractured person, I wouldn't put Picasso in my home if you gave me an original. I'd try to find a good price for it. But I certainly wouldn't put it up. Because the man's consciousness is fractured. And what I want in my home, especially somebody I've got to live with, is a friend. Odierna's is a friend, but how he made that those lovely lights and colors and so on is by contrast. God did that. He created light and beauty in this world, and He created it by contrasting it with evil and darkness. And evil also is an instrument of God, but at the same time, the light and the beauty is meant to stand out. It's not meant to be all rejected. If you can stand back from it all, how do you enjoy a painting? Not by rubbing your nose in it, you stand back from it. How do you enjoy anything? By standing back a little bit and seeing it in proportion to everything else. Not to just get lost in one thing. Not to get so sucked into a mood like Clair de Lune, which is, again, I repeat, I love it. The only thing I don't like about it is that my piano teacher made me spend a year mastering it on the piano. But apart from that, it's a beautiful piece of music. But you stand back from it and be centered in yourself, and you can enjoy all things, because all things feed back into your own center. What is it that you're affirming? You should affirm God in everything. See God in everything. Meditate deeply so that when you, in your meditation, you feel that presence, then don't just keep that presence locked up. That's why we have this place called the expanding light. You find the light within, but then you want to reach outward. Jesus made a very interesting, what looks like a paradox. He said, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing when you give. And just the chapter before that, in the Gospel of St. Matthew, we find him saying, don't hide your light under a bushel, but let it shine so shine before men that they shall see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Now, isn't this a contradiction? First he's saying, don't even let your left hand know that you're doing good works. And then he's saying, let your light shine before men so that everybody can see your good works. It's certainly a contradiction, if you take it literally, but it isn't a contradiction if you understand it from within. Because he's saying that your light is what he wants people for people to see. Not the things that you do, but your light, your consciousness, your aura. The more people can feel God flowing through you, the light is the godly part of you. The outward things, the gifts that you give, and the drums that you want banged for all the charities you've given to the synagogue and so on. That's what he was talking against. But when you have people who, they don't talk about what they do. Their emphasis isn't on the things. It's on this inner flow, this light. If you say yes in that way to that light, if you enjoy in that way, if you see that light in everybody, and if you expand that light and not just your own ego, then that's your good works. They will see the fruit of your good works in your eyes. They don't have to see the hospital that you built. I've been so pleased to see, for example, Birla, who built Birla Temple in New Delhi. He was a very wealthy man, and he had acquired all his wealth by his own hard work. In fact, what happened was that he was a devotee, and he wanted to be just a hermit. And a saint said to him, look, your whole family are merchants, and it's your own dharma to make money. You have to do it to complete your own dharma. But if you do it to glorify God and not yourself, then it's a good thing. And so in that thought, he went out and very quickly became a millionaire because he had that skill. But then he put it into this beautiful temple that he built. And he himself lived a very simple life. He was just a devotee. When I met him, he was a humble man. You'd never have thought that he was the great millionaire who built this temple. I remember a saint that I met who was so knowledgeable. He had, 100,000 or 200,000 books in his library, and he knew all of them. He could tell you if there was any reference that he wanted to look up, he'd say, look in that closet and that shelf, book number so-and-so, look on page 133, and there you'll find what we're talking about, and that's where it would be. He was a man that everybody who knew anything about these things respected. He was probably the most learned scholar in India, but he was also a saint. And I remember when I went to visit him, I came into the house there, and I looked around, and I thought, well, there's somebody who's probably the cook, but where's the saint? He was the saint. He did. He was so just very simply dressed. He had sort of an undervest on, and just didn't show anything, except when you talked to him, you saw that he was a man of great wisdom and also great power. One time at a party, somebody was saying that, well, you can talk all you like about the power of the mind, but I still say that the body has a power over the mind too, that the mind can't control. For example, I bet you couldn't drink 6 bottles of whiskey and remain sober. And so the saint said, well, bring me 6 bottles of whiskey. And he drank them like that. I don't think you could drink that much water. But he went on talking philosophically and calmly, not just completely untouched. Didn't affect him at all. And another story that I've always loved was Ramdas, Swami Ramdas, who was such a beautiful saint, such a humble man. And when I met him at the hotel in Los Angeles, first of all, a tall, imposing-looking young monk came out, and I thought, oh, this must be the great Swami. And he said, no, just a moment. And so the elevator door closed and went up again and came down again, and then it opened, and out came this little man with no teeth and no hair and sort of waddling like a duck and looking so sort of cute. But he was so full of love for God. And you saw that it wasn't the outward thing that mattered. It was the consciousness that matters. It isn't your ego you want to express, it's that light within. And you will see that all really great men are humble men. Master, in his comment on Luther Burbank, who he said was an American saint, was that he always made me think of a fruit tree laden with fruits that bends low to earth. It's only the proud tree with its barren, the barren tree that lifts its branches high to the heavens. And so, Master said that humility was what made it possible for Luther Burbank to come up with so many inventions. In fact, one of the great objections of many of his contemporaries in botany was that they couldn't duplicate his experiments. They felt he must be doing something fishy, but it was a matter of the consciousness of the person doing it is a very vital part of it too. He had that humility, and so the energy flowed and the plants obeyed him where they wouldn't obey other botanists who came in more aggressively. Another interesting thing about Luther Burbank was that they used to say that as he was working with his plants, he would keep his eyes sort of half open and half closed, looking up here. And this is the way that all great creativity is done, whether you're looking literally like that or not. I remember when Master interpreted the Bhagavad Gita, wrote his interpretations for it. I remember that he would just close his eyes, half open and half closed, and look up into the spiritual eye, and it all flowed through him. He said, I tuned into Vyasa and let Vyasa write it through me. Spiritualism, in fact, originally wasn't just communing with ghosts. It was communing with saints, and this is good. To commune with a saintly soul and allow that communion to... this is how you put yourself in tune with God. Master one time said, he was talking about Chaitanya, and he said, let me tune into Chaitanya and let him tell this story through me. And then he told the story of Chaitanya's life. But in this way, this is true spiritualism, when you can commune with a saint, and you don't have to go into trance for it to happen. You just sort of put yourself in tune, and then you find things happening and being said and being done that are things you wouldn't have done on your own. I remember a lecture once, I was sort of sitting back listening to what was happening and thinking, gee, I wish I'd thought of that. But that's how it works, that you don't do it. He does it through you, and the more you put yourself in tune with the divine and say yes to this flow of life, not with attachment to anything, but just let it be centered here and let the flow go like this, you'll see that then everything can happen well. In the superconsciousness, we have the only reality of consciousness. Everything else is a filtering down from that consciousness into lesser manifestations of the truth. Your reality is samadhi. Your reality is not this conscious mind you're living on now. You must reclaim that reality as your own, and then you will know that this never really was, even except as a dream. This isn't who you are. In this lower consciousness, we see distinctions between things, and seeing things different from one another. We see them opposed to one another. We see them in conflict. We see them clashing against each other in opposition and enmity. In the superconscious, you see all things as one. And thus the conscious mind tends to be problem-oriented, as I've often said, and this is the fundamental principle of superconscious living. That the conscious mind is problem-oriented because it sees distinctions, it sees obstacles and obstructions. But the superconscious mind is solution-oriented. And if you can get into the superconscious, you find that automatically, instead of thinking of difficulties, you think in terms of how you can do it, not why you can't. Automatically answers come to you. You will see that if you want an answer to things, because there isn't any problem in the world that doesn't have its corresponding solution. There's a solution to every problem, even if it be only the Zen solution of destroying the vase. Sometimes the only answer to a problem is just to banish the problem, but that too sometimes is a very valid solution. There is a solution to everything, and the highest solution of all is to live in God's love, and then the problems don't even exist. That's again why you don't need to count your faults, but just count whether you love God enough. So, if the superconscious is solution-oriented, and if when you have a problem and you just hold it up to the superconscious and you can get an answer, then why not live in that thought right now? Because the way to attune yourself to the superconsciousness is to live superconsciously on this level too. To understand the principles of superconsciousness, to understand the principles of a divine way of thinking and living and being, and then try to incorporate those principles even at this level. For example, if you have problems, put yourself in an affirmative attitude. Even if you don't have the answers, Jesus said, pray believing. When you pray believing, you're praying with the consciousness that the answers are going to be there. And you will find that in that very act, mental act, you are putting yourself in tune with the way the superconscious works, and then it can work through you. Why do we concentrate here? Because this is where the mind comes in superconsciousness. Well, then you may say, okay, well, when I'm in superconsciousness, my mind will go there, so why do it until then? The reason is that if you work in the way that the superconsciousness works, put your mind here, and it'll be easier for the superconscious to flow. Many Christians say, well, why practice yoga? It's all God's grace. Yes, it is God's grace. Yogis say that too. There's nothing new about that. In fact, in India, you will find the word grace, or kripa as it is in their language, used a lot more than you ever hear it here, even in the fundamentalist churches. I would say they even overuse it. Because, as Buddha said, we have to do something too. But the fact remains that if you work in accordance with the way that the flow of grace happens, you'll find it a lot easier. For example, the flow of grace is from above down. It's not from the side, it's not from below, it's not from behind. It works in a certain way. The superconscious is above. That is to say, it's when the energy in the body and the consciousness in the body are in the upper part of the body, and above all, when they're centered here. Now then, if you deliberately keep your mind down, as if to say, God, all right, if that's what you are, prove it. It's not going to be nearly so easy. Somebody wants to fill your cup and you turn your cup upside down, how can he fill it? God wants to fill your heart with grace and you close your heart and say, all right, God didn't fill my heart with grace. Whose fault is it? you turn your cup up, you open your heart, you empty your heart so that it's so that there's space there for his love. And then it works, you see. So you need to cooperate with grace, and that's what yoga really is all about. The flow of grace happens in a certain way. It happens when the energy is flowing upward to receive that grace. If a guest is coming at your front door, will you be in the back door waiting for him? No, you go to where he knows he's going to arrive, or you might never hear the doorbell. You listen to God in the ways that God comes. That's why we meditate, lifting our eyes, concentrating here, raising our energy, practicing Kriya to get ourselves centered and uplifted. And the same thing is true in the simple practice of saying, yes, I can. Because that's the way the superconscious works. And so many people in this world say, yeah, but we got to be practical. And then they fall back into the same old slough of despond, as Pilgrim's Progress calls it. In fact, we do need to be practical. In fact, it never comes that people achieve anything if they are vague, but you never find saints who are vague. As Sri Yukteswar said to Master, divine perceptions are not incapacitating. You don't become a fool by becoming a saint. Rajashi was always in a state of bliss. He was always in samadhi. When we would see him, he was very generous in blessing us, and he would, as soon as he'd see us, he'd come over and just sort of touch us like this, or put his hands on our shoulders like this, and just try to get us to feel waves of bliss. And then he'd smile. Maybe he'd say one word or two words, and then he'd go away. He hardly ever spoke. And you might think, seeing somebody like this, that he's so much in the clouds that he doesn't know how to pay the grocery bills. But yet he directed a business empire by telephone. And he just knew how to touch the right things. On the phone he would say, all right, this, this, this. And always from samadhi and always back into samadhi. One time the boys from the church in Phoenix, the ministers there, came, and they were. He asked them to give a report on how things were going there. And so they they thought, they were talking, and he was just sitting there blissfully. And they thought, well, he's not even listening. So they perhaps didn't put enough energy into what they were saying, because they made a statement that was inaccurate after about 20 minutes, half an hour. And he said, no, that wasn't the figure you gave me back at the beginning. He remembered the exact figure. He remembered everything. He was concentrated on that. Being in God doesn't necessarily take you out of this world. You can be much more in this world if you are in God. But you find that God is with you. And this is the wonderful thing, that when people don't live in that way and they just see the trees around them, they see all the obstructions and obstacles, then they never get anywhere. They can sort of, with a great deal of effort, slog their way through to the next clearing. They never come out of the woods. The truth of it is that when you really live in that I can consciousness, then God, in fact, also helps you. But I've seen it happen many times in my life, and in the lives of others who have used this principle, but with energy. Remember, that's the difference. That when you do it with energy, with faith, that it isn't as if you have to do it all. He really is there. Now, you can't do big things first. Do little things. And those little things will give you the faith to do a little bit more, and then a little bit more, and a little bit more, and then finally, then you really know that something's happening, and somebody is watching out for you. And then, see, any faith exercised one step beyond your present experience is the way to make that experience and that faith grow. More than one step becomes presumption. You have to base it on your real experience of life. But any step, just one step beyond your experience, in this way you expand bit by bit into a kind of faith that can presumably move mountains. I don't know that I have that kind of faith, therefore I say presumably. But I have done a lot of things in my life with faith. And it comes from saying yes to life. Saying yes because that's how the superconscious works, that's how God works. He doesn't say, yeah, but if I make this planet, then what's the problem? Maybe I need another one. He doesn't think that way. He knows. He knows exactly how to make things happen because it's all in the flow. And when you're in that flow, things happen without any effort at all. When I went to see Sai Baba and he materialized a necklace for me, he just did it like that. And unless it fell down from a sleeve, in which case that sleeve must be awfully full because I saw him doing a lot of things, giving a lot of things to a lot of people. It was actually what seems to be materialized. But no effort involved because he was completely in that positive flow. So it is that if you will say, I can, and then put all your energy out for it, you will see that it comes. Another thing that is very necessary, and this was touched on when I said that divine perceptions, quoting Sri Yukteswar, are not incapacitating. What I mean is that you must be very clear in your mind. Superconsciousness is not muddy. Many people think that they are going to write a great work of art, or a great poem or something, by going into the subconscious. And what they bring out may be nice, but it won't be truth. It won't be superconscious. You don't get it by being so vague. If you listen to a lot of rock music, in fact, a friend of mine who writes is a famous rock musician, he said that you have to write lyrics that don't make much sense, that almost make sense, but if they're too clear, then people won't take it. I don't agree, but I guess if it were rock music, that might be true. But personally, I prefer to be clear, because I know that that's how the divine works. But that kind of music is all subconscious anyway. And so the words and everything, they sort of hint at lots of things, and by deliberate vagueness, the hope always is that people will think you're profound. And your hope always is that they will see a lot of things in it that you, for heaven's sake, haven't seen, but okay, if they can see it, great. But the truth is that if you really want answers to problems that are real answers, you've got to be very clear with your questions. 9/10 of getting a good answer is making a good question, posing a good question. If you know clearly what you want, whatever it is you're doing, whether it's music, whether it's work, whether whatever, it will express that, but the inspiration won't come if you aren't clear. If you can say yes clearly to life, understand where you're saying it from, understand what aspect of life it is that you're saying yes to. If you're saying it with an I can attitude, with non-attachment, saying it's all God, therefore there's no fear. Why are people able to do beautiful things? Only those are able to who are not attached. Who understand that there's a flow. And then, if you can have a very clear idea of what it is that you are trying to do. I've noticed, for example, if I'm writing a brochure, simple thing to write. Every organization needs to write things sometimes of that nature. But I've found that what I do is get a very clear picture of whom I'm writing to. So clear that I can almost see him sitting across my desk from me. I feel I can talk to him, with him. And he's a composite of all the people I'm trying to write for. But he's a living individual. And when I see it very clearly and feel that he's real, then I have no trouble, it just comes. Because I'm talking with a friend. And you'll see that whatever problem it is, if you instead of thinking, because so many people are just always running in circles like chickens with their heads cut off, and they there's a problem, all right, let's do something. No, just get centered, get calm, see your way clearly, and you will be able to resolve a problem in a minute that otherwise might take you a year, years. People can sit and discuss in committee meetings things for months and never get a good, clear answer. The most important part of a job well done is the period spent before doing it. Get back and just think a little bit. Get very clear in your mind what it is you want to do, what it is you're wanting to say, what kind of solutions you want, and then say, yes, I can do it. I need an answer, and the answer is. I found many times that I can't get an answer to a certain problem until somebody asks that same question of me. I ask it and it's not clear enough. When he asks it, it comes to me more clearly because it's focalized in a person and I know the answer instantly. You get a clear enough focus to your question, say yes, and the answers will flow automatically. That's the divine way of working. It's the art of superconscious living.